Veterans Day.
Happy. I don't think that's something you say. Happy Veterans Day.
Do we want to say Happy Veterans Day?
No.
Do we want to say?
Welcome. It is a Thursday night generational change, which we have switched to Wednesdays, but because it is Veterans Day and we are doing a special, we are here on a Thursday.
Yeah. And obviously there is a lot to talk about this evening, but of course, you know, this is one of those circumstances where we wanted to have somebody who was not only a veteran, or we wanted to have those individuals who were not only veterans, but actually speak out against, you know, the hypocrisy that goes on a day like today. Because all anybody really wants to do is thank a veteran. If you really want to thank a veteran, there's a lot more you can do than putting up a nice post on social media.
I don't know. I always think of these kinds of days as days where basically the people who have been righteously sort of anti-imperialism get guilted for not supporting the troops, and it's just, it's more nationalistic than anything else. And I've always resented that. I've never liked that. And the best way to support troops, well, is to stop sending them to places that they don't need to be, but maybe take care of them when they come home. Just a suggestion.
That could be linked to a lot of different things that we've been dealing with over the years. But of course, we are not going to let our very special guest wait.
No, and I just have to preface this. Like, I'm a little bit fangirling. Like, this is definitely the biggest thing for me. Like, so far doing this show, like the biggest get, like, for me. Like, it's a little bit strange. Although James Taylor retweeting me last night is pretty huge also from that concert.
I guess I was just...
James Taylor, Jackson Brown was awesome.
But that opportunity to...
But I want to just say that basically everything that I've learned about history as an adult comes from Oliver Stone. Like, and it's in a way, like, I'm grateful. I'm very grateful, but it's also sad to me that I've had to spend a very good portion of my adult life relearning history because we're not taught proper history. And then of course, when I read Danny's book, Danny Scherzen, who is supposed to be here, hopefully be here any second. But that was also another like good re-education. I think we should be, I'm telling you, I think we need history recertification like every 10 years or something like that.
Well, we're going to get ourselves a history lesson.
Something, because it's just pathetic. And I feel, you know, it's taken a lot of deprogramming. So this is very exciting, guys. This is a very exciting
He's
thing.
He's a Vietnam veteran and Academy Award winning director. You know a lot of his work, most notably Platoon, Wall Street, and JFK. And of course, he is one of the most outspoken.
And I'm more of natural born killers, born on the 4th of July kind of.
Well, he kind of was a filmmaker that's been way ahead of his time in a lot of things. Most people also
don't
involve him with Scarface.
I love natural born killers. And it was really, I mean, it was definitely dark and out there. And I really dug it. So I don't know what that says about me.
No, it actually says, what's amazing is natural born killers came out right before O.J. Simpson's trial. So
I don't know what makes you think of that. Like, I'm sitting here thinking, I found Woody Harrelson attractive as a psychopath.
It's America's obsession with smut culture.
Yeah, well,
that's a whole other story. But
and Rodney Dangerfield is
yes. Well, that's yes, he was.
I digress.
But without further ado,
yes,
we are very pleased to welcome to the show for the first time and hopefully, definitely not the last time, Oliver Stone. Welcome to Generational Change.
Hi.
Hello, Jen and Pete. Peter.
Yeah.
Very nice to meet you, sir.
And I call you Jen.
Yes, definitely. You can call me Jen. It's really, this is a huge privilege. Like, honestly, short of, you know, Chelsea Manning singing me happy birthday on my 50th birthday, this is like up there as like the coolest thing ever for me, just so you know. In May, I turned 50.
Wow, you don't look it.
Thank you. Oh, now I like you more. Really, when I say that, I feel that so much of what I know of history, I have learned from you. The documentary that's on, it's Netflix, right? I saw it on Netflix. The Untold, is that Netflix?
It was on Netflix. It was before that. It was on Showtime.
It's so good. I mean, honestly, that, just watching that changed a huge thing for me. Like, that was a very opening for me. And the key thing I took away from that is that we're just repeating the same things over and over and over again. I didn't know the story about Henry Wallace. And then when I was watching that and then knowing I feel like it's exactly what happened to Bernie Sanders. And we just keep repeating it. And the same thing is true with our imperial empire, is we just keep repeating the same things over and over again. And I guess my main question for you is, do you feel like we've learned anything? You know, I mean, like, have we made any progress?
I don't want to be depress you on Veterans Day, Jen. It's very hard to believe that we have. Our education system keeps churning out the same material. They don't really change it. They pretend to change it. But you don't get a thorough picture of World War II, which is crucial, and the American changes after World War II. And that's what we really were, that's what motivated me to do the series, was to get to the heart of this thing. Why are we in these wars? Why have we not changed our way of thinking? And I think the answer is, over time, has come very clearly to many of us, is that money is at the root of this.
Right. I mean, yeah, it's all for profit. And, you know, people seem to know the Eisenhower quote, like people somehow know that quote. But I don't think people really understand the depth of the problem that we're dealing with and the magnitude of the issue. And obviously, you definitely touch on this with JFK. And then I went down this whole rabbit hole from something on what you said about the Dulles brothers. And then I ended up down this whole rabbit hole of stuff. And I can totally geek out about that. But I know you have something you wanted to say.
Like, no, I'm actually listening right now. And I think it is very important.
You said something. You mean I touched on it on JFK. I have a documentary coming out on Showtime on their app and on their network, their cable station, coming out on the 20th. I think it's the 20th. And the 12th, they have the app. Showtime app, and then it will be wider in January. But this is called JFK Revisited, and after 30 years, I went back and I looked at the film, and I tried to put all the facts, the most important facts that we knew about the case, in one framework for an audience looking for a documentary. Not remember, the 1991 film was a dramatization.
Yeah.
And I had to take liberties to make it into a film length, but it was pretty accurate, I thought. And this is a real update for you. And I think those people who care will be really moved by it. There's a 2-hour version that's coming out, and then also available will be a 4-hour version. And we care Wow. about this. We care about this because the lessons of Kennedy still apply today. Yep. It's ironic that our president, Joe Biden, is an Irish Catholic. And if anything, he should have some empathy for this man and what happened to him. And he unfortunately postponed the release of the last so-called last documents another 3 years recently. According to the reason given was COVID.
Right.
COVID prevent people from reading files or opening them.
You know,
I'm running out of excuses.
They are. And what's interesting is growing up. So I was in high school. I think I was in high school when Platoon came out. So you were definitely framed as somebody that was radical and conspiracy theorist. And like, you were definitely painted that way. And obviously, as I got older, I realized, yeah, no, that's not how this goes. But how has that been for you? I mean, obviously, you don't really give a crap, but in terms of that sort of, you know what I'm saying? Like, is that, you've obviously heard these things. And it's so funny to me, because to me, anyone who would believe that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone is just, that's insane. Like who would think that? That's just ridiculous.
It is ridiculous.
I know, right?
It's ridiculous because, well, just from the visual evidence alone, you can see the very first reaction of the president is he reaches for his throat. Now, it's obviously, to those people who do any kind of reading, it's from the front. The shot is from the front. So the moment you have another shooter, you have a shooter from the rear, you have a shooter, you may have two shooters from the rear, you may have a shooter and a shooter from the front or more, you have more than one. And
right.
How do we know that? Because the Zapruder film locked it down to 6.3 seconds. The crime took place in 6.3 seconds of shots. It doesn't work. It doesn't work at all. And the film, the documentary, goes to great lengths to disprove the ballistics and the fingerprints, the rifle, everything that happened that day. All of the basic evidence that the Warren Commission took to make their judgment is flawed. It wouldn't hold up in court, and we show you why. I don't want to belabor it, but it's really important that people understand there was more than three shots. It was probably five or four, I think, or six. I'm not sure. No one knows exactly what happened.
But we know it wasn't one.
But we do know that there was more than one direction. Right. There was wounds. Okay, there was wounds in his. Every one of those bullets can be discussed.
Well, the whole, I mean, James Tague alone just completely eliminates the magic bullet theory, and just every story that came out. And of course, I was younger. But I can remember very well Christmas season '91 when the film came out, and the way that it was just branded as such a controversial film. Because again, even as a kid, you're in school, and I was always fascinated by the presidents. But when they said that, oh, some guy's trying to suggest that, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald did not assassinate the president, you know, could you even put in perspective what it would be like today in the information age and the, you know, mile a minute media age that we're living in today? If you were to release a film like that now, what that would have been like? And the hysteria that may have surrounded it. Because there was hysteria 30 years ago, Oliver, but today, I can't even imagine what it would be like in this information age.
Well, today they would have been multiple cameras on the assassination. There would have been iPhones, and there would have been all kinds of technology. This thing would not stand up. I don't know exactly where we want to go with this conversation, because I don't want to drag it into, but the film is very important that people see it. And I think people will be interested in seeing it, even if they know nothing about Kennedy, because we go out of our way to paint a picture of a warrior for peace. Kennedy was a whole generational change from the previous Eisenhower and Truman administrations. He comes more as a descendant of Roosevelt, in the 1930s and early 40s. In our untold history, we go up to great lengths to show the differences between Truman and Roosevelt, and how Truman dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the attitude of opening the Cold War, creating a Cold War. Now we have to get to the basis of what was the Cold War about, and whose interest was it to begin a Cold War? And we keep coming back to the same information. Truman declared the Cold War when he declared the Truman Doctrine against Greece and Turkey in 1947. Then he formed the CIA, and he did all kinds of things to keep that. He was told by Senator Vandenberg, the Republican, create fear in the American people. That's the way you're going to get this thing financed. The actual model for the Cold War is Nazi Germany, actually. The people who were in Wall Street, like my father was in Wall Street, and he was a Republican, so I grew up with this mentality. I understand it. And my father was an intelligent man. I don't put it down. But people like Paul Nitze, for example, was a Wall Street broker. He married an heiress. He was in the 29 crash. He married an heiress and he went on to be one of the fiercest advocates for militarizing our economy. His argument was the Depression is going to come. It's going to come back again. We can't employ all these people. We've got to militarize this sector of the economy. And he said the best example of this was Hitler. He had traveled to Germany in the 1930s before Hitler became the bad guy. And he much admired the resurrection of the German economy through war, through militarization. Same thing was true of Mussolini to a degree. So you have all these Wall Street guys like Forrestal, Nitze, and the richer people than that even, who are admirative. And you have to go back to the history of World War II to understand how America supported, how many Americans supported the fascist movement in that time.
Oh, yeah.
From Lindbergh through the richest people in the country. But they didn't, of course, when the war got hot, then they backed off. But many of them kept trading with the Germans. And we go into that in Untold History.
So we do have a question. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
No, so you have a very suspect, you have a very strong fascist movement in the United States, especially in business circles. So Nitze comes up with this concept that the best way the American economy is going to survive with all the reentry of all these men from World War II is militarize the economy, which is what they did gradually. Eisenhower was a big role in that. He played the most important role, and he's at fault for this, and he knows it. And I think that's why he said it at the end of his term. Right. He regretted it, but he didn't do anything about it. He created the biggest nuclear arsenal in the history of mankind. We still haven't recovered from that. And Kennedy actually contrary to everything you may have heard, was moving in the opposite direction. The moment he got into office with Robert McNamara as his Secretary of Defense, McNamara went over to the Pentagon and he asked very tough questions. He said, is there really a missile gap? This is what they were saying, that Kennedy was saying during the actual campaign, but he didn't know the facts. McNamara came back and said, no, there's no missile gap. We're way ahead of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is busted. They went through a war that wiped them out. 27, 8 million people were killed. They're not going anywhere. They're not hardly going to invade Europe, much less do anything else. They're really trying to recover. They're interested in keeping the peace. So, but we invent this inflated threat that Russia is about to invade Europe. And obviously because of the Eastern European situation, which also needs to be talked about, but we're not going to do that all the time. We're not going to get into a long discussion on it, but it's important that you understand the origins of these things. Otherwise, you're lost. You're living in a threat world, a world of threat. Oh, the Russians are against us. The Chinese are against us. The Iranians are against us, blah, blah, blah. They'll tell you anything you want. They'll hype it and they'll hype it. The media, it was very important in this matter. They, of course, reinforce the argument again and again, and the congressmen who don't know anything, they come together, and of course they vote for the bigger appropriations, and before you know it, we're spending, what is it, $1 trillion a year now to prepare for war, not to go to war. Preparing for war is more important than going to war, because going to war would ruin our economy as well as the enemies, the so-called enemies.
Well, that's why there's a huge difference between supporting our troops versus supporting the military-industrial complex, which is very, very distinct. We do want to obviously get your opinion. I'm sure you do have a lot of thoughts about what or who was responsible for JFK's assassination. I maintain it was the CIA. I can't think of any other logical explanation, but certainly if you want to share.
But Lawrence Steiner wanted to know if you think it was Alan Dulles. I mean, yeah, you got to read, what was the Devil's Chessboard?
David Talbot's book.
That to me was great. And that was part of the rabbit hole I ended up going down from your movie.
Yeah. David's a very smart man and he did a lot of research. And I think it's a great book. He also wrote another book before that called Brothers in 2007. Brothers is about Jack and Bobby. It's a great book. I urge you to pay attention to it, because a lot of the problems that crop up with the Dulles brothers are in that book. In fact, John F. Kennedy had more enemies than you can count by the time in 1963 rolled around. You have to remember the Pentagon was furious with him. There was an atmosphere, people talk about this openly, atmosphere of hatred for him because of what he did at the Bay of Pigs. And then he compounded that by backing down at the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 in October. By not going to war, by not attacking Cuba, he angered the Pentagon lords as well as the CIA. He fired the chief of the CIA, Alan Dulles, and his assistants. And unfortunately, he didn't clean house. That was the problem, because at the end of the day, Richard Helms took over the CIA, although he was the assistant to McCone. Helms was a pure Dulles guy. And Dulles saw this. The Dulles brothers saw this as a titanic struggle between communism and Americanism and democracy, so to speak. And they were willing to go to any ends to destroy communism, even war. That was their danger of this situation. And the missile crisis was as close as we came to the nuclear holocaust that we all fear, because unknown to the American side, the Russians had missiles in Cuba, quite a few, and quite a few troops too. More than 1,000, anyway, several thousand. And they were ready for it. I don't know if they were. It was a very dangerous situation, a hair trigger, the closest we've come to annihilation. I was a boy, I was in school, and we were pretty scared back then.
Yeah, my parents grew up in South Florida, and my mom remembers being on Miami Beach, and they were doing the duck and cover and all of those things that they were teaching them. And it was definitely very tense here, for sure.
You cannot praise John Kennedy enough for avoiding war. It cost him his life, but he really, really believed in peace. He made a beautiful peace speech. He signed a nuclear treaty with Russia, the first treaty we ever had with Russia after World War II. this is amazing. And the nuclear test treaty was an amazing achievement. He was proud of it beyond belief. And he died within 2 months of it.
Listen, his speech, the commencement speech he gave at American University in June of 63, that's one of the maybe five greatest speeches I think a president's ever given. And if anybody has not heard it, it's probably the best anti-war speech, the most unifying of the world speech I think I've ever heard. And what was it for you in 1967, 1968, that you ultimately decided, I am going to go serve my country, or were you simply drafted and that was just the way it was?
No, it's a little bit more complicated than that. But before I go into that, just you should check out also his speech he gave right before that on civil rights. It's one of the most beautiful speeches I've ever heard. And it came after the problems at the University of Alabama with George Wallace. It's a beautiful speech. And the historians have not given him credit for stopping him and Khrushchev, because Khrushchev played a huge role. And they grew together closer. They grew closer together. And so that was what led to the nuclear test treaty. But by this time, they were both reviled by the hardliners in both their governments, the Soviet hardliners and the American hardliners. And the strange thing is that Kennedy disappears from the scene, as we know, in November, and Khrushchev, less than a year later, is ousted. So the two heroes who saved the modern world pay for it in a deep way, in a deep way. Khrushchev lost all his power and was basically exiled, and it was a sad story. What happened for me in 1967-8, my parents had been divorced. It's another story. I wrote about it in my memoir called Chasing the Light, which if you have a chance, you might read it. But I didn't want to go to Yale. I didn't want to be in that group. I didn't believe in this elitism that you see now in this country all over the place, this elitism of the East Coast think tanks and all that shit. I never believed it. Something was wrong with that generation. George Bush was in my class at Yale as a freshman. That's to say I knew him. I didn't know him, but he was a type of personality that took things for granted. He was an elitist. I didn't want to take life for granted. I had read too many books and this and that. I wanted to experience life in a very down-to-earth way. So before I went to as a soldier, I was I was a teacher in Asia, in Vietnam, and tremendous experience. And then I joined the Merchant Marine to get a taste of reality, but apparently it was not enough. So when I came back to the States, I ended up going back in 1967 as a volunteer draftee, which was a way of saying, I'm going to go in for 2 years and I'm not going to extend it into 3 years as an enlistment, because I didn't like Army life. I wasn't an Army oriented person, but I found out very quickly. I found the war pretty quickly, actually. 6 months, they trained me and sent me over there. And before I knew it, I was wounded the first time in October of 67. And I had a second wound in January of 68. The war was intense in 67-8. And it was, I learned a lot. I don't want to go into all that. But essentially, I felt that I'd done the right thing because I had no understanding of the war. I saw it as my father had seen an East-West struggle, communism versus democracy. The domino principle was the principle of, if we let Vietnam go, Thailand and will follow, Indonesia will follow, et cetera, et cetera. It didn't pan out. When it did, when the Vietnam went communist, so to speak, it didn't follow that way at all. So their scenario was not accurate. And after that, it took me a long time to come around. I mean, coming back from a war is not easy. It took me a few years. And I listened to people like Jennifer and you, people in school. I went back to college under the GI Bill at NYU, film school and all that. And people were, it was in the air. And I was in New York, so what do you want? People are very liberal there. And I got a whole taste of another life and talked to people, experienced life. And by the late 1970s, I was beginning to have a picture of what our country was doing in the world. The picture developed over the time that I had a career. And by the time I made JFK in 1991, I had formed certain conclusions about why JFK was killed. He was killed because he wanted to change things. Generational change, that's what it was about. And he couldn't get it because these people were seriously hated him and wanted to destroy him. He was a threat to them. And if he had been elected, which he would have been in 64, in my opinion,
yes.
Bobby Kennedy would have followed in 68. It made sense. They saw that picture of a dynasty, like a Roosevelt dynasty, that would go 16 years, maybe more with Teddy. So there was a real fear of Kennedy. By segregationists, by militarists, by people who thought he was soft on communism, people said he was a traitor. All that was going on. The 7 Days in May was a great film. It's about that issue. It's about what was going on in the White House. Kennedy didn't see the film, but he read the book, and he thought it was a great film to make.
I think it goes without saying that your experience over there in Southeast Asia really translated in a very profound way. I did not see Platoon until about 2 months ago, first time. And
because you were too little to see it when it came. I mean, I remember when it came out.
No, but the point I'm making is that there are many profound scenes in the film, but the scene that obviously stands out the most, of course, is the scene where they pillage the village. And it is so raw. And again, I don't want you to delve into too much detail because it's obviously very personal and private, but I have no doubt that a lot of those experiences that you put on film have to do with things that you saw personally when you were over there. There is a very big mystique that our country, that our citizens, millions of our citizens believe that we are this benevolent nation that is bringing freedom and peace to the whole world. When in reality, it isn't just Vietnam. It's been going on for generation after generation. We are the bad guys in many instances. And even in 1986, you were willing to put that out there at the height of Reagan's popularity. You put that out there. And I have no doubt that even though, you know, you won the Oscar for it, there were a hell of a lot of detractors who were like, what the hell is this anti-American guy? Forget him, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You know, it took a lot of guts to do that. And that is for those people who haven't seen Platoon, that is a very, very tough scene.
Yeah.
To watch Kevin Dillon, Tom Berenger, of everything that went into that scene. Is so gut-wrenching, but it needs to be told because it really, if anything, captures the fact that our country is not that innocent.
We're not the good guys. We're not the good guys.
Whoever said we were, that was a mythology we all bought into. I've long been dissuaded of that. The difficulties of getting that film made are unbelievable. It was turned down everywhere. I was watching Rambo being made. I was watching Chuck Norris films, Missing in Action, all the bullshit.
Delta Force.
Propaganda. But I had to live through that. My script was being rejected. They were making a ton of money. Who knew that my little film would actually make a ton of money? That's what's amazing about this. It's like an Alice in Wonderland reversal. It's just unbelievable that nobody expected anything. Our script was turned down 20, 30 times, 40 times, never made by anybody. The only reason it got made, goddammit, was the English. An English producer, an independent producer, had the guts to make it. And it was off the back of my other first film, Salvador, which also was a low, low budget film about the Civil War down in Salvador, which I experienced through a friend of mine, a journalist, Richard Boyle. Those two films, back to back from 85 and 86, got made against all the rules and at a low budget, extremely low budget. And unbelievably, Platoon was a hit around the world, every single country. It made, in the United States alone, declared $136 million. But abroad, it made a lot of money too. So certainly, Hemdale got, the company got launched on that. And I did okay, I did well. But it launched my career, and that's important because I kept going. I didn't give up. I went, as you know, within three films to Born on the 4th of July, which is even tougher film because it goes into the Ron Kovic story, and he got paralyzed over there. And have you seen Born on the 4th of July?
I love Born on the 4th of July. And,
that's Tom's best performance.
Yeah, that and Interview with the Vampire was really good too. But yeah, no, that movie was really intense. And I remember seeing that and thinking that. And I saw Platoon in the theater, okay, because I'm old enough. And so I remember that, and I did. And I was very surprised that Tom Cruise did that, because at the time he had, it was like Mr. Top Gun and Days of Thunder. Yeah. And, you know, he wasn't really serious yet.
The gods were with us. I can't tell you, I'm surprised too, because Top Gun was actually the highest grossing film of that year that Platoon was made. I think we were the third or fourth, but Top Gun was Tom's maverick. It was his trademark, but it was a film. It was actually a very dangerous film, because at the end of the film, it suggests that World War III is about to begin and Tom is going to fly off and lead the Air Force into attacking the Russians. That's really what it suggests at the end. A terrible ending. They're remaking it. That shows you where America is today. They're
remaking it. We keep repeating, right? Well, they've run out of ideas.
They want the money. The success of that film. And Tom, much to my chagrin, and went back to make another one, but okay, that's what he's into. I was very lucky to get him at that time. He was at the right age. And Ron Kovic had a tremendous influence on him, which was good, powerful influence. And we got it made barely, again, with a tight budget, and with a studio behind us. And they backed it. And believe it or not, I won an Academy Award as a director. The film was not blessed with that. They gave it to Driving Miss Daisy, which was one of the earliest black-white films that came out. Very successful.
One thing that I did really that was very intense for me from Born on the 4th of July was the experience that he faced coming back. Yeah. And what the VA was like. And also my husband, who is a physician, I remember when he did his rotation at the VA, we were in, first in Indianapolis and then in San Antonio. And it's never good. No. Like, they're always the worst treated. That to me was very eye-opening. And I'm wondering now, since we are on Veterans Day, like, have we made any progress? You know, I from when Ron Kovic was in, you know, the Kovic hospital. Yeah. Like, have we made any progress?
I don't know the answer to that, Jen. Thank God I'm not I don't go to the VA. Yeah. But I've been to a few of them with Ron. And where he's at now is good. It's not a bad one at all. It's Long Beach. So he goes down there and he says the care is good. And I believe him. But he said to me at the time that in the Bronx, it was terrible. The Bronx of 1968 was awful. And there were rats. People wouldn't take care. They'd be yelling and screaming and all kinds of fights and disagreements. It was a mess. And I don't know what the solution is, because the government has dumped millions and billions of dollars into the Veterans Administration. And it doesn't seem to. It seems to me like it's part of the American waste, the extravagance of waste. We spend too much money in the wrong way. I don't understand it, why they can't fix that problem. Or if it is a problem, I'm not sure anymore.
Profiteers, but we, of course, here support single-payer healthcare. And if we all just had healthcare, then there wouldn't need to be different healthcare for people. So everyone would just have healthcare.
There's also no profit in taking care of.
I mean, you'd abolish the Veterans Administration. You'd abolish the VA.
Well, you wouldn't. Yeah. I mean, if everybody was entitled to get taken care of how they needed to be taken care of. Now, I think there should still be veteran services, because there's certainly things that are specific to veterans that they need, you know, support services. But as far as having separate hospitals or different facilities like that, I don't know. I don't know that that's necessary. I think that if everybody has health care, everybody has health care.
Yeah, it sounds good, but it's always between execution and the idea and the execution. I don't know. I've never understood this debate. I don't understand the U.S. budget. The money we spend, it seems to me, I don't know. It just feels like we need to have a better economy, more control of what we do. Our management of these issues is terrible. It's like our management of war. We go to a war, we mismanage the war. Now we have a situation where there's 100 generals for every soldier, it seems. Like, you have too much brass, too much higher command, and you don't have the, I'm not going to get into it, just Iraq and Afghanistan are pathetic issues of mismanagement.
I know. I was hoping Danny was going to be here. Danny Scherzen was supposed to be here.
Because I would like to get into it with him too.
Yeah, he's supposed to be here. And I don't know what happened, but one of the things that he has said to us before was like sort of his moment when he was serving where he realized, wait a minute, this is not, they're being told this is some successful thing. Meanwhile, we've accomplished what the mission was and yet we're still here. Like what is going on here? And the message is very different from what we get. Obviously, we don't ever get the message here. We never get the truth here.
Well, we see all too often that the biggest reason why endless war continues is because of the fact that war profiteering makes people ungodly rich. And you have these, so many of these military industrial complex entities all throughout the United States, Raytheon, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and they buy off the majority of our elected representation on Capitol Hill, both parties. There is no differentiation when it comes to war. That is pretty clear. And that to me, that really is, I mean, we always say on our podcast, we always say corporate special interests is the issue of our time. And no greater level is it reached than with the military industrial complex. Yep. That is why we do not have the things that we should have, why we're still circling the drain in regards to our war machine. And until we put our differences aside and recognize that this is our issue and what we need to fight on the same lines on, then nothing's going to change. It will continue and it may get worse.
I have to change position because I'm running out of battery.
That's all good. I was loving your, okay, well, look, you have another library wall. I was loving the library wall behind you. And I have a sneaking suspicion that you've probably read all those books.
Oh, most of them.
That's just amazing.
It's like going to school. You have to keep looking at it again. You know, people forget. I forgot my glasses. Oh, shoot.
No, this is what I keep saying about, like, I really think we need to have like history recertification almost. I mean, first of all, people my age and older, probably even down to your age, we were never taught proper history in the first place. They're still not. I mean, they're still not. But at least there is this access to certain information.
No, yeah. But it's getting worse now because they're trying to suppress information.
Well, that, yes, but because of the internet, we can access accurate information. Whereas when I was growing up, there was no that. Like there wasn't an option to even access information, even if you suspected.
Well, something. If the internet is, there's a lot of prejudice. I mean, I admire the internet. That has allowed me to expand my knowledge. I agree, but there's a lot of, you know, a lot of political ideology on the internet, especially when it comes to the enemies of our country, whether that's China or Russia or Iran.
It's whoever is going to be the most profitable, I think. And what I always think from my perspective is I really don't care what nationality my oligarchs are. Like, it really doesn't matter to me if it's Russians or Chinese or whatever. It's the global haves. And the have-nots is really the bigger issue. And the rest of it is just them playing stratego and creating fear-mongering so that they could keep pillaging every country's resources. I mean, that's really what it seems like to me. And I don't care if my oligarchs are Russian.
I like your thinking. You're a very interesting woman, Jen.
I
can't believe you're 50.
Yeah, well, and the fact that you're the first guest who's ever really made use of the generational change,
the like best
context.
That's like good. This is, and the fact that you just said I was interesting, it's like that's really the coolest thing. And I, you know, I got to say, like,
you're alive, you're reading, you care
very much.
All I see on television, I don't even watch American news. It's you see generals with fruit salad on their chests, getting in front of committees and saying we have to go here and have to go there. They hire the same creeps, zomboids, after they retire, put them on CNN, and they reinforce each other. It's an echo chamber for war or preparation for war. You know, everyone is threatening us. We're the biggest country in the world. We're the richest country, and yet we act as if we're a scared cat and that we're running away from the dog. This is not true, and it's the kids get this false information about, as I said earlier, the Cold War is the biggest fraud pulled off on mankind. Biggest fraud, and it's the most costly. it'll be seen in historical terms, whoever comes out ahead or not, it'll be seen as a fraud, a real fraud. This is propaganda.
Yeah, I feel like we're still having it though. Now it's just, well, it's more, I think we're getting more Chinese, but we're back to Russia. We can't really decide. We're kind of all over the place. You know, I mean, if Venezuela had any real power, I'm sure we would care a lot more about that.
Well, remember
when we think about Venezuela, Venezuela is a very easy explanation. 25% of the crude oil supply that exists on this planet is underneath their soil, and we want it. And that's it. I mean,
they had the audacity to suggest that their people benefit from their natural resources. And so we couldn't have that happen. No. And that's
now it's becoming, well, if we can't convince the Americans that we have to go fight all these wars overseas, maybe we can fight each other at home, you know, dividing and conquering amongst our citizenry. And the fact that there is such and corporate and Mr. Stone, if you can really speak to that, corporate media is probably even more powerful now than it was when Walter Cronkite was on TV. I mean, today, you can talk about probably the two most significant pieces of policy that took place in the last generation, the fairness doctrine that Reagan overrode in 87, and then, of course, Clinton putting forward the Telecom Act in 96. And what we have seen over the course of the last generation is the consolidation of corporate power in such a way that the propagandizing of our citizenry is amazing. It's absolutely off the charts insane how bad it's gotten. And they just put gasoline on the fire. That's why I tell everybody, do not watch corporate media. Not watch CNN. Do not watch MSNBC. And do not watch Fox News, because that is not news.
It's brain poison.
It is.
So what do we do? I mean, what does a little guy do?
We're in a lot of trouble because big tech is now in their pocket, because they know that independent media like the channels that we've worked on. Hell, you used to have yourself, Jesse Ventura, Tom Hartman would go on RT America. Well, they figured out, oh, they're putting out information that's actually not good for the empire.
Well, no, they don't. They will not tolerate anti-war voices. Mm. It's anybody who's ever spoken out against a war will not be tolerated on those networks.
And so they have to.
I haven't been invited back in a long time.
I'm sure that really upsets you.
Well, you know, it's a shame that my documentaries, I've made 9 documentaries, that they don't get on network television. They get on some obscure, generally speaking, a cable, and not always the best cable, but sometimes I get lucky. But you know, you can't get anything intelligent or challenging out there. They just don't have the space. They're more interested in advertising. And even when you get it out there, they're cutting away all the time for some commercial. It's very hard to keep the message in mind. I'm amazed at the lack of education on public television. We'll call it network television. It's disgusting. I was in a house the other day, some city you don't know about, and there was no cable, so I watched network television. I can't believe how sparse a diet it was. It was mostly commercials I had to sit through.
What are some of the, and are there any veteran organizations that you do work with? You know, because one of the things that we want to highlight is, you know, we don't
get
enough.
It is Veterans Day.
It is Veterans Day, and you are one of the most noted Vietnam veterans that I can think of. And, you know, I do think that this is a very important issue because of the issues with the VA. And, you know, we want to do everything that we can because, again, like I said, there's the separation between supporting our troops and not supporting our military-industrial complex. The corporate media does a really great job of suggesting that, well, if you don't support the military-industrial complex, you hate the troops. It's like, no, that's not.
That's how they keep it going. They make us feel bad.
Bingo.
They try to guilt us into supporting their endeavors.
Yeah. I know. I've seen it all my life. I wish Danny were here. This is where I'm going to fall a little short for your purposes.
That's okay.
We tried. I'm very surprised that Danny's not here.
Yeah. I mean, he's been on us twice. No, I don't have a cell number. Just right. Email. But yeah.
I haven't stayed in touch with the veterans organizations. I participated in the VV, Veterans Against the War, and I went to their convention back in the 80s. And, you know, I spoke out very radically about the war. I shocked a lot of veterans. I can't agree with this support of the government's policies. It's so wrong. And we just, there's no sense of contrition as to what we did in Southeast Asia. I just can't believe it. When so many people were killed, so much damage was done. They're still having chemical problems, biological problems out there. Mm-hmm. And this, I see the same is going to be true of Afghanistan and certainly Iraq.
Yeah, we're not learning. We keep repeating the same things over and over again. And I think part of it is, well, it's connected to that we don't educate our citizenry. So as people aren't learning, we're not learning from our mistakes. And then all it takes is one or two generations go by. And then it's sort of easy to repaint the picture and make it be, you know, or just wash over it. And so that's the thing we keep repeating. And I feel like what we're trying to do is this constant battle to keep people informed. And I see it now, it comes up a lot with them trying to suppress what they're calling critical race theory, otherwise known as just history. And they seem to have a real problem with us teaching that we have an inherently racist civilization here. Like, they seem to have a problem with that. And it's so that just more suppression. And I just feel like that is how we get set up for 100 years from now, doing the exact same thing, because all of the voices that are saying this now are suppressed. So it's very frustrating. And I'm so appreciative that you have broken through that. Oh my God. Sorry. This is
our mascot. Nice looking dog.
Thank you. It's Lulu.
She's our mascot.
She's the mascot, but I am very appreciative for one. Seriously, I feel like I could write a book saying everything I've learned about history that I need to know, I learned from Oliver Stone. And that shouldn't be the case. Well, and probably some Ken Burns. There's definitely been some like other documentary people that I have watched, but we shouldn't have to be reprogrammed.
Well, Ken Burns' view of Vietnam is wrong, I think, and he takes the point of view that we're the good guys there and we intended to do good, and he glosses over all the evil we did.
This is why he's allowed on PBS.
When you have a madman like Curtis LeMay, chief of staff of the Air Force under Kennedy, if you remember, yeah, who bombed the shit out of Germany and who bombed the shit out of Japan, he wiped out Japan. I mean, and then, of course, the bomb, the atomic bombs, but he didn't do that. But he was the bombing lead on Japan. And then he did the same thing in Korea. People didn't even think about it. Korea was wiped out, the North and the South. There was a civilian population. There was no differentiation between civilian and military. It was the most brutal campaign. And it continued into Vietnam. He wasn't there. He died. But the same mentality operated. Bombing was okay because you're not down on the ground seeing the results. So you drop bombs. John McCain, I could not stand that man when he was, I'm sorry, he was, many people think he's a great senator.
No, not here.
He bombed the shit out of, and he had no regrets. No regrets.
No, these are, like, to me, I think of most of these people as just war criminals, and we just have no recourse because we're that powerful. So there's no recourse. They could just do whatever they want. I think pretty much most people in the past three administrations should be incarcerated. So, you know, but we don't really get to that.
The General Petraeus is a good example. It's funny because he missed the Vietnam War, but he comes up with this whole theory, the counterinsurgency theory for Iraq, where he's going to fight the war successfully in Iraq. So he uses this, basically the same thinking of the Viet Cong and NBA. And he goes about it, and it's a disaster in Iraq. It's a disaster. We cannot organize or manage a war anymore. We do not have that ability. We lost that ability because we're filled with hyperinflation. We're filled with lies. We don't tell ourselves the truth. The architects for fundamental architecture of our society, it needs to be trimmed and made economical again. And I don't see that happening, even close to it. So talk about climate change. I mean, we're spending a fortune on this thing. And I don't think we're going to get the same results that we'd like to get because we're spending so much money, we think we're solving it. Maybe it's got to be solved by thinking and doing less and using our brains, using our technology with energy, and using our new minds that are looking for solutions, including nuclear energy. It's very important that we understand how to use energy and what all these windmills are. you know, we can build all the windmills we want. Whether that's going to solve it is a big issue. I don't think so, because it takes a lot of land, and I think solar has the same problem. Well, I'm all for expanding them, but I do think there's a limit to which we can go.
Yeah, we talk about that. And I think that we believe, we're so, you know, humans believe that we could just switch over from, you know, fossil fuels and just keep living how we're living. And the reality is that we can't do that, because there are a lot of things in the way we live that are completely dependent on fossil fuels. And instead of changing the way we live, we think we could just sort of put a Band-Aid on that and try to get that power from using renewable energy. And I just don't think, I think there's going to be major compromises that are going to have to be made.
You made a great point.
Well, we have to keep working on the research with these new energies, because there are ways to get away from oil to a certain degree. Cars, for example, and airplanes, these things can be rejuggled. Yeah, there's a lot of good new work being done. I was just up at the Idaho National Laboratory, and I saw great work being done.
I want to go to Idaho.
No, you definitely made a great point about the fact that nuclear is the transitional energy.
We've said that
in
before.
In terms of the base of, if you want to get away from coal and natural gas.
Actually, young people like you have been finding that out. What's interesting is that the environmental movement, when you study it in detail, a lot of it was supported by the oil companies. Rockefeller was the first one in 1957 to see the way. And he put money into Greenpeace and things like that. Oh, I forget the first one was called, but they put money there because they did everything possible to block nuclear energy. They knew that was a solution that they couldn't outcompete. So they did work, and the environmental groups heard it quite a bit. But some environmental groups have come around now to see. But the young people, is a difference is when you talk to a young person, they're not scared of nuclear because they say the end of Earth is far more concerning to them than nuclear war.
Yeah.
That's the truth.
And their perspective is very on point. We work with a lot of youth down here, and a lot of them are also vegan. Like for them,
yes, that's a big thing too.
Our diet and things that are really proactive about what we need to do in order to fight this. But the truth of the matter is, and maybe you caught this the other day, this was absolutely fantastic. You know, they're doing the dog and pony show at COP26 at the climate summit. You know, why Nancy Pelosi and Frank Pallone are there, you know, doing their little speeches about how, oh, you know, we're gonna solve all of the problems now because Trump is not in the White House anymore. Yet you guys are still spending $1 trillion on the military, and they are the biggest purveyors of, you know, environmental disaster as anybody. And so hats off to Abby Martin of the Empire Files, who called her out the other day. Spectacularly done. And of course, she totally didn't see it coming. So Pelosi was a total deer in headlights. And I'm assuming that you were able to catch that. I mean,
no, I haven't, but I heard about it.
Oh, it was amazing. Amazing. And to me, that's
everything. Yeah. Abby's doing a great series, apparently, on the Defense Department's.
She's one of the few journalists we have left. You know, she's one of the few that people can watch. As we wrap up, are you okay? No, he's coughing.
I'm okay.
Okay. So somebody had a question, and I know you said it earlier. You were talking about the JFK Revisited and that it's going to be on Showtime, right? That's where it's starting on Showtime.
It's starting, yeah.
Okay. And then hopefully after that, it'll end up back on Netflix.
Well,
it'll go on Netflix.
That one I don't know. I can't tell you because that is a controversial subject. Netflix tends to be scared of controversy. So, I mean, it will get out through Amazon maybe at least as a commercial release. I can't guarantee any platform anymore. Showtime is stretching to do this, and they've done it. We'll see what they do. The app and all that, but we will have a deal by January for a general release, I guarantee.
But what we're talking about, people, is Oliver's project, JFK Revisited. It's an expanded look and an updated look at JFK. And you said it was 4 hours. There's a 4 hour, there's a 2 hour
That's
version.
Coming out also, you know, 2 hour and a 4 hour.
Okay.
Bucks, people who care to really get in, 2 hours to familiarize.
That's like us. We're like, that's like us. I just get into these things and then I just start going down and then I have epiphanies. My only question for you is the one place where you did not update me, where I had to deprogram myself, was on Israel-Palestine.
Yeah.
That's something that, and as a Jew in South Florida, has been very hard to deprogram, growing up with post-Holocaust grandparents and this whole very fear-based, gotta protect Israel, gotta have Israel, you know, everything about Israel. And to speak against that as a Jewish person has not been easy. And that is what, that is, I think, the only real controversial thing I did not get from you.
Well, you know, as I'm in the hot water enough, I got a lot of shit. If back in 2004, I did a documentary called Persona Non Grata. And it was about I went to Palestine and Jerusalem, and I went to the other side. I went to the Arabic side, and I was in Ramallah when the Israelis came in. And we got out by the hair of our teeth because of the Canadians got us out, our documentary crew. It was quite an exciting time. But I was called all kinds of names when I spoke out for Palestinian rights. And next thing I knew, I was reviled in the Western press, and there was a lot of heat. That happens a lot. So the people are doing that all the time, but you know, you forget about it. But essentially it burned my tail off. And I'm very sensitive about that.
You were called anti-Semitic. Is that it? Were you anti-Semitic? Okay.
Of course.
I'm a self-loathing Jew.
I am too. My father was Jewish. My mother is Catholic. So
it's even harder. And the Zionism thing is big. I mean, that whole generation, it was very, very big. Let's say what they were taught.
There's an interesting story on JFK that you may not know, which we have in the 4-hour version, not in the 2-hour version. JFK was very concerned about David Ben-Gurion, and Ben-Gurion getting the bomb was a big deal back in the 60s. And guess what happened? JFK was resolutely against them working on the bomb, and he was about to put a stop to it. He warned them, he did everything possible to stop it. He didn't want proliferation of the nuclear weapon, and he was right. And guess what? At the moment he died, of course, Lyndon Johnson, who reversed every policy he made except on civil rights, Johnson went ahead and closed his eyes. The Israelis continued to build the bomb in 68. I believe it was 68. At that reactor, they have Dimona. They finished the bomb. And Johnson never even told anybody. It's typical of a hypocrisy, but it's the American, that is the American, the third rail. Don't go after Israel.
I always say that. I'm like, Israel is the third rail. They're rail. That's the thing. I mean, it's always a problem. And especially in my district, It does not go over well.
Do they allow you there? Or are you back for Yom Kippur or what?
I am a non-practicing, very secular. Really, I'm an atheist. And I was raised by hippie parents who grew up in, you know, very Orthodox Jewish household. So I'm sort of a hybrid of those things.
So you have a site for both sides.
I do. Well, I grew up with Orthodox Jewish grandparents. I know what that looks like. I know I've been to Israel. I have family that live in the old city. Basically, all they do is study Torah and breed. And that's basically it. So I'm very familiar with it, but I don't appreciate religion in general. That's just not, it's just not my thing.
One of the last things I do want to mention, Mr. Stone, and I'm not sure how much you studied up on Jen, but she did run for Congress in 2020 against none other than Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
Good for you.
Very, very unique experience. But the thing that I really took away from the whole from the whole campaign and all the things that you learn is that of all the things that doesn't get talked about enough with Wasserman Schultz is just how deeply embedded in the military-industrial complex she is.
Oh, yeah, huge.
I mean, she is as in with it. You don't become the head of the DNC for 6 years if you are not very, very friendly with the military-industrial complex. And so that is the side of her political career that, to me, never gets talked about enough and really needs to be highlighted more, not just with her, but with all representation in general. Because if there's one thing, as we talk about, that Capitol Hill unifies on, it is war and it is the military budget. They will agree 99 times out of 100, but that just goes to show you how much corporate special interest money in the military makes a difference when it comes to our policy in this country and frankly, all over the world.
and they couldn't even get us good rifles in Vietnam. The M16 was a terrible rifle. The Kalashnikov is still around, and people like the Kalashnikov. We can't get good rifles in those days in the U.S.
I would think, if anything, what we're really good at is weapons. In fact, I'm pretty sure that's our main export as well.
Not necessarily. The F-35 is a disaster. You've read all these years and years of problems with this plane. Not necessarily. The Russians are much better with weaponry because they build economically. Look at the Russian budget, $70 billion a year versus $1 trillion a year. They're building weapons that work. Hypersonic missiles that came first. In other words, weapons don't not have to cost money. I think what the cost is, a lot of this, obviously, our way of budgeting, but it's because of the lobbyists. It's because of the money goes into winning congressional approval for these budgets as opposed to actually building the weapon.
It's profit. It's all profit. I often say, like, let's say the Russians, like, if let's say our fear of them is founded, when people say something about the Russians, I'm always like, what do you think they're going to do? Like, what are they going to do? Are they going to, like, come up on the shores in boats with guns? Like, what are we concerned with? Their economy is the size of Spain's. Like, I don't understand. What is the deal?
It's actually the biggest chimera we've ever. It's so grossly exaggerated that one day we'll wake up and we'll say, what happened? Where'd all that money go? You know, right. Where'd the country go?
I do think we're getting close to something like that. And now the question becomes, is there going to be a big enough anti-war movement in the United States that's going to allow for the reduction of the military machine? And the reason I think that that could potentially happen is because of how directly linked now military action is to climate disaster. And because there is such an amazing youth movement in this country that really fears the end of, you know, the planet, or at least the potential where sustainable life on the planet is not going to be possible, at least for a significant part of the population. And so if enough youth really start to hone their skills in terms of how they want to go after this, if they go after the military-industrial complex, there will be millions upon millions of people that will say, yeah, we're not having this anymore. And that will be reflective in electoral politics. You see what they're doing to Joe Manchin right now. If they get better and more efficient at it, they're going to really be able, we can really ride the back of this new generation that is basically saying, yeah, we're not doing this shit anymore.
Pete, from your lips to God's ears.
I also want to say before you go that Wall Street is one of the most profound films I've ever seen.
JFK's, he's obsessed with Wall Street.
JFK's the best.
He's obsessed with Wall Street.
But there's multiple scenes in that movie that I think are very important. But I also think that the scene in particular, obviously everyone says greed is good is what won Michael his Oscar. I think it's the speech right afterwards in his office where he basically tells him how the world works. That's what won it for him. But to me, the scene in the movie that always stood out the most for me is when Charlie's character makes his deal with the devil on Park Avenue. You're basically being told that, look, you could be that working stiff out there. You're going to tell me there's a difference between that and the other guy, but you got to be willing to do what is necessary. And that includes cheating. And so that scene to me, I think, just really has so much profound impact as it stands today, because a lot of people are willing to give up their ethics in order to get what they want. People are willing to invest in companies that they know are destroying the planet, but it's going to make them a lot of money. So throw all of your morals and values out the window. Do you want this life? Because if you do, this is the only way you can get it. And when he leans in and says, all right, Mr. Gecko, you got me. And that smirk, I don't know how many times you had to have Michael do that take, but the way that he just...
He's sort of like a movie savant. Don't mind him.
But that smile was the devil... He reeled it.
I remember that.
I got him. I got my guy.
Okay, so before you go, no, one more thing.
Michael Douglas conveys that smile.
What's your favorite movie? It could be one that's yours or one that's not yours.
Don't ask me that. That's
come on.
I happen to like movies very much, like Pete, and I have hundreds of movies that I wouldn't be fair to so many good movies, so many good filmmakers. It's really a fountain of richness. And we have to dip into it again and again. I wish movies themselves, I hope they never die, because I see television. They never run movies hardly. You know, television is only creating their own programming now. So I don't know what's going to happen to the old movies. I really pray that they don't go away.
Well,
including mine too.
No, for sure.
As long as there are people out there that will appreciate.
I'm so appreciative that you have taken your platform to educate and not just make movies. Like, I mean, it's using that for the common good and the collective education as opposed to just financial gain. And it's a huge difference. And it's very apparent in your work. And I'm very appreciative.
We are very appreciative.
Thank you very much.
I think that these conversations are very important on days like today because everybody wants to wave the flag
today. Yeah.
Talk about how much they love our veterans. If you really love our veterans, you'll start talking about the need to reduce our military presence around the world. That's a start, but that ain't all of it. And if you guys, please
check out JFK Revisited. And it's coming in January, yes?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, without the platform, it will be abroad in January. Yes.
I have to say, in a roundabout way, it actually worked out better. This is our first time talking with you. We hope it won't be the last.
No, and I am a little concerned that Danny didn't show up. Like I am. And someone made a comment that they haven't seen a tweet from him in a long time.
Danny's been out of commission for a little while. So now we're,
I'm going to have to be like worried about that.
Yeah.
So now it's not very polite to do what he did. I mean, he's been unreachable, actually, and I don't understand it.
Yeah, no.
Unfortunately, there's, you know, and maybe it's today.
I don't know.
But what we can say is that this conversation has been deeply enlightening, deeply rich in context.
Thank you so much.
I can always listen to
you. Thank you so much. We're such small potatoes, and thank you so much for coming on our show.
And all right, Jane, hang in there, baby.
And we certainly hope to speak with you again in the near future. Mr. Stone, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
So again,
coolest thing ever.
Yeah. And he was the way he was throwing generational change.
He was great. Was so no. And seriously, like he's just a wealth of.
May I please one more?
Oh, my God. He's like Peter Sick. That was really cool. I am concerned about Danny because I know that he likes to come on this show. It's not like.
But the reason I wanted to.
And he's the one who really kind of coordinated this for us. And so I'm a little concerned.
No, but somebody said that something's going. So something's clearly going.
All right. Well, guys. So let's, which concerns me. But yeah.
But the reason why I wanted to bring up the conversation from Wall Street and the reason I bring up that particular scene from Wall Street is because when we think about, why is the military able to do this? Why are people able to get away with this? You have publicly traded companies that are military operation. People will make money by any means necessary.
Well, it's the same thing that we say about corrections. It's when you give a profit motive to something, it changes the whole dynamic and your priorities are no longer what they should be. And so anything where there's a profit motive, your priorities are going to be skewed towards the profit. So that is the problem. And something like military shouldn't be a profit industry. It really shouldn't be a profit industry. It should be a function of defense, should be a function of our government. It shouldn't be something where shareholders and investors and that's the problem. I have no problem with having a defense. What we have is an offense. It's the Department of Defense, and I find it very offensive. So that's the problem. I mean, the last time that we actually had a military action in defense was Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
I guess people would say 9/11, but I have a problem with considering that because it's not a state actor and it's a lot of different things. But
many different layers that go into it.
Right. And so it's different. But so World War II, the Pearl Harbor was the last time that we had what we would call a need for defense.
And of course, it was also an attack that probably, if it couldn't have been prevented, certainly was known about. Remember, a lot of things happen militarily. No, ahead of time, like they already know you're going to be attacked. Like,
and actually, people should read Danny's book is amazing, even though he's not here, which is the true history of the United States, and it's amazing. I did the audiobook, and it's really good. It's sort of like
we knew we were going to get attacked on 9/11.
Yeah,
like we knew that was going to
happen, and we were actually expecting it in August.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of stuff that goes in, which is why
determined to strike.
Yeah.
In the U.S.
Yeah. No, there were memorandums. And when you get into history from people like Oliver Stone and his untold history that's on Netflix, guys, it's amazing.
It is.
It's amazing. And I could talk to him for hours. But one of the things that was so cool is that it really starts off with the primary in what year was it? Oh, my God. 38. What year was the primary when they shoved in Truman instead of Wallace? But anyway, guys, check it out. So this was a special Thursday Veterans Day edition. What do we have coming up this week?
Well, Sunday is a packed day, as you know.
Sunday we do have quite a day. But we will be having Brian Klass on. He is somebody who wrote a book. The book is Corruptible. And I'm going to binge listen before he comes on.
That'll be fun.
Yeah. And then what do we have coming up?
We have a couple of guest
shows. We're going on a couple of shows on Sunday.
Yes.
Who do we have on Wednesday? Okay, so Wednesday is really cool. We're having another sitting congressperson coming on Wednesday.
Representative Marie Newman.
Marie Newman's coming on.
She's running in a new district because she's been redistricted.
Shocking that they don't want someone like her.
Yeah, why would they want
why would they want a non-corporate?
Yeah, of course.
So we will be talking with her, and I'm going to commend her for having a certain grace about her and a level of maturity that I shall never achieve. Because if my office were across the hall from Marjorie Taylor Greene,
yeah,
and that witch was instigating at that level that she's instigating, I think I would have ripped her bald headed. So I have to praise Representative Newman for her level of maturity and decorum that I most certainly would not have. Just saying.
Yeah. And again, you know, we've got a lot of great guests coming up.
Yes.
Tonight really was.
That was awesome sauce.
Somebody who we really appreciated and have appreciated for a long time. The one thing I didn't mention also about JFK was his use of, was it John Williams that did the music, but the music in JFK.
I don't know. That's usually Spielberg's person, but so I don't
so
know, but it might have
well
been.
Executed.
Okay. So I'm noticing that you have that interview on Wednesday morning. And then that evening we have two guests that night. So we have we're doing two live streams on Wednesday.
No, we're going to do what we're going to
record. Oh, okay. Okay. I'm like, how are we doing that? Okay. So our Wednesday evening will feature our discussion with Representative Newman. That's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
Is that how we're going to do it? Which will be a first for us to do it that way. So bear with us.
It'll be fun.
And then we'll be speaking with Harvey Kay and John Shelton. Harvey Kay is somebody who's trying to radicalize us, which I think we very much need to be radicalized.
Well, leave it to Wisconsinites to do that because they really are one of the original radical states. And so
anyway,
that to me is
thank you for joining our special Veterans Day Thursday night again. And
I don't know the next time we're going to have a Thursday.
We might not. But so we will see you guys on Sunday. And
so before
anything else,
yeah, I want to
put up our little Patreon, guys. If you're not patrons, be a Patreon. We need to add Mallory's name to our list now. I have a couple of people. Yeah. Sorry, guys. I've been definitely remiss since my big move.
Yes, but why don't you tell everybody about last night?
What was last night? Oh, my concert. Like, what was last night? So last night, my first concert back since COVID. And I have to say, I have definitely really missed live music. I knew I missed live music, but I really missed live music. So last night I went to go see.
The music is by John Williams. I was right.
Okay. Last night I went to go see James Taylor and Jackson Browne together. And if I like, this is up there for me, like when I saw Billy Joel with Elton John, like this is two people together that I could not love each of them more individually. Like so for me, Jackson Browne, and I've heard him now sing The Pretender live twice. It's amazing. It really is amazing. Pretender is one of my favorite songs. Hearing him sing it live is one of the coolest things ever. Until last night, now the more coolest thing ever was listening to Jackson Browne sing The Pretender while James Taylor comes out playing guitar and singing along. Now that is the new highlight of everything. Like that was really, really cool. It was amazing. They both sound great. And the musicians that are with them and the backup singers. And I've really missed live music. I get in the zone. I was in the zone.
And the fact that Mr. Taylor acknowledged our Instagram post.
We posted about me being at that concert and then James Taylor retweeted that.
I was like, wait a second.
My comment on James Taylor. Get me James Taylor on this show.
I don't think
I could handle it.
Yeah,
I could barely handle. I went and saw Ben Taylor, his son. James Taylor's oldest son And it's his son with Carly Simon. His name is Ben Taylor. He's a musician. He's amazing. His voice, he really sounds like James Taylor.
I know Jen's going to hate me for saying this, but of course, my affiliation with James Taylor was his guest appearance on The Simpsons. In
oh, for God's sake. Go, this is crazy. My point is, is that Jay, and last night and on his tour now, James Taylor's youngest son is one of the backup singers. And in the end, they did this two thing together with the two of them sitting there with guitars. And it was really cool. And James Taylor's voice still sounds like butter. It is, the smooth.
Sweet dreams.
And if you guys, and for anybody, if you have not seen Jackson Browne, it just does not get old. And he has a new album that's just really good too. Like I like the new stuff. I was in the zone.
It certainly sounds like it was a great show.
And it's funny because Jason was there, my husband was there, and his friend was with him. And I was basically doing my best to not really, they were doing whatever, they were talking and doing their own thing. And I was just, I felt like I was there alone. I was so content.
Well,
I like going to concerts alone.
Jen obviously was in her element.
I was in my element. Actually, my best concert experience ever so far, like as, you know, recent years, let's say, was 2 years ago. My family was on a cruise with my in-laws. They were on a cruise for New Year's. I don't cruise. And I was fortunate and I last minute got a seat and went to go to the Billy Joel show New Year's Eve at the BB&T, which is where I saw the show last night. And it was so good. I was just by myself. I was in the zone. It was good. And I was really close to backstage and I saw them handing out champagne at midnight down there. And I saw somebody gesture to someone else on his team. They went like this. And I knew that they wanted weed. And so I handed my bullet and my lighter down to one of the roadies with Billy Joel's team. And I handed it over the side because where my seat was. And he came back. They went and smoked up. Then he came back and he gave me, I have a staff t-shirt from that New Year's Eve. He gave me the Billy Joel staff t-shirt for smoking up some of the roadies. So that was my very cool. No, but I did make eye contact with him for the second time in my life. I have made eye contact with Billy Joel twice because when he came out, I went, "Hey, Billy." And he looks up and he smiles, but I was like, literally, I was close enough that I was able to hand my weed down to his team. So I was close enough to do that. That's what I'm saying. So this was, yeah, it was very good.
Show again, be the weed lady.
I've seen Billy Joel where I got to sing in the microphone too. That was another show when I was pregnant with Graham. And I was like right up in the front and he held the microphone down. Now, do I think he knows that was the same person? Of course not. And that is, of course not. But I did make eye contact twice. The first time was actually in 86 it was the Bridge Tour. And then again, 2 years ago. It's true. Eye contact.
I haven't been to that many concerts. And my concerts are limited to the Boss.
Springsteen. I've seen him plenty too. I will pretty much see. I'm a live music person.
Well, you went to the Orange Bowl in the Born in the USA tour. That's pretty bad.
I saw Prince's Purple Rain at the Orange Bowl, which was called the Purple Bowl. It opened with Prince having a bubble bath and getting out of a bathtub in a G-string on stage.
Definitely.
Purple fine. Bubble bath. Sheila E. opened. And I have seen The Boss, Born in the USA.
This is what it feels like when doves cry. That's for sure.
Don't mock Prince, man. Prince was like the
1999.
Bomb. Okay, and let me tell you, I would love to have Roger Waters come on and talk about some of this stuff with whistleblowers.
Tex King.
Yeah.
That's who you
got. We have a mutual friend.
Yes. So with that said, I unfortunately am fading with my voice.
And I need to go eat. But guys, this was great. I mean, Oliver Stone finds me interesting. That is up there with the Chelsea Manning singing me happy birthday this year in terms of like highlights.
He's good people.
He finds me interesting. I think I'm fascinating.
The most interesting woman in the world?
I might be.
Maybe.
I'm very bizarre.
Just remember, you can thank a veteran and thank them on days not like today.
Thanking
a veteran today is cheap. If you really care, you start making the effort necessary in order to make sure that we don't have to deal with this going forward.
The best way to serve our veterans is to stop putting them in wars for profit. Mm-hmm.
And for those of you who haven't seen all of Mr. Stone's work, highly recommend that you check it out.
Oh, yeah. There's some serious, like I had forgotten about Natural Born Killer, like that he did that. Yeah, he also did The Doors.
He also did, a lot of people to this day still don't realize, even though Brian De Palma directed it, but Scarface really was Oliver Stone's movie.
Oh, was he a producer of that? Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. He was the writer. He did, yeah, him and I wasn't going to bring it up. Apparently him and Brian De Palma hate each other. So that was a very serious problem when they were making that
interesting
movie. But you know, Stone's
His body of work is beyond impressive. Oh, yeah. And it's very specific pieces done in a very smart way. And that is what I respect. It isn't just making movies for the sake of making movies. It's making movies to teach, educate, put something out there that's inspiring and causes us to use our brains.
And what I really appreciate about him is not just his voice and what he stands for, but the fact that he really appreciates his work. There's a lot of people, especially in the entertainment business and acting and things like that, you hear all the time, like, they don't even want to look at their work. They don't even want to acknowledge their work. Oliver talks about his work like, you know what? I really made some great stuff and I'm very proud of it.
And I think that when you use your platform and your voice and do things like that, it definitely affects how you view your body of work. Like, you know, he has a lot to be proud of and he's obviously does a lot of research and it's very important. Not enough people do these things.
If and when, knock on wood, because I'll follow up with Cassandra.
You need to find out what happened with Danny.
But we'd love to have Oliver come back and talk about other projects. The one that, obviously we could have dived more into, we didn't really talk about Wall Street, but obviously.
Because it's Veterans Day.
It is. But talking about Natural Born Killers.
Oh, I love that movie.
I think
freaking love that movie.
Because, again, the whole obsession with, you know, smut and the fact that we
violence in general, all
that stuff. And again, this was what made it so interesting is the fact that Oliver released Natural Born Killers just before OJ committed that double murder. So it became sort of like life imitating art in a way. He knew that the country could be heading in this direction of we're so obsessed with violence. And maybe a lot of it did stem from the Rodney King riots and the whole.
I think we've always been very violent. We're very violent people.
We're a very voyeuristic society.
Well, and we're inherently, apparently violent. Here's the thing is that a lot of his movies really tackle violence abroad. And that movie really addresses violence here and in a much more like, street way. If you guys haven't seen Natural Born Killers, I highly recommend. Also, I would like to shout out Robert Downey Jr. in that movie, who was amazing, per usual. And really not a main character. I mean, he was kind of like a sidebar. And also again, the late Rodney Dangerfield was amazing in that movie.
I'm telling you.
And honestly, that was when I knew I truly had true love for Woody Harrelson. And this was before I knew that he was a fellow partaker. This was long before I knew that. This was Woody Harrelson. When you can find someone extremely appealing who's psychopathic and killing people, you know that they're doing a good job because it's not easy to make that look really attractive. And he sure made that look really attractive.
Woody Harrelson's always been able to capture.
Is he still a partaker? I think he might be. I think he might be dry. He might be, which I would respect. He's every like vegan and all that. But I think that he might be dry. But there's certain people that are on my, I would love to smoke with. You know, like Snoop Dogg, like there's certain people that just notoriously, I would think pot smokers want to smoke pot with. And Woody would be up there.
That person one day. In a but it's been a very eventful evening. And again, remember the importance of.
Oh my God. We should have a show called like Smoking Pot in Cars. With me.
Or Weed Wednesday.
I love Weed Wednesday, but like it could be like we get people like other people who smoke weed like and we smoke in the car.
Or in the new studio. Depending on
That's true. We could like Joe Rogan that. Yeah. I would smoke in here. It's just us in a very small room and it's just not that fun. But it would be more fun if certain people would come and partake. Mm-hmm. I would get like a big hookah and do weed. We haven't done that since college. I went to Boulder people. We're very creative.
Thinking of new creative ideas, but that's what we're about. We hope you enjoyed the show this evening, and we will definitely be seeing you guys on Sunday. Have a good night.
Bye, all. Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.